Welcome to Oh God, What Now? I'm Dorian Linsky. On today's show, Rishi Sunak's Rwanda plan has passed the Commons after a vigorous round of ping-pong with the Lords. What happens next to what has somehow become Sunak's flagship policy? Plus, the local elections are coming next week, with many Tory councillors and mayors saying thanks but no thanks to the PM. What should we be looking out for, and how bad could it get for the Tories? Very bad. And in the extra bit for Patreon backers, Tony Blair has warned that the future of politics could be a parliament full of the weird and the wealthy. With the Tory majority already eaten away by increasingly bizarre scandals, are we already there? And why aren't we getting the MPs we deserve? Let's meet today's panel. First, it's Time magazine journalist Yasmin Sirhan. Hi, Yasmin.
Hello.
So American media seems to be absolutely obsessed with the wave of pro-Palestine protests on college campuses, especially at New York's Columbia University. What do the students want, and how have the authorities responded?
Yeah, it's been pretty surreal. It feels like it's been going on for a while, but it's really been only in recent days that we've seen the kind of scale of protests that I think we've been observing in major cities like London and the rest. But basically what's happening, and as you say, this is principally at Columbia, though we're also seeing a lot of focus at Yale and Connecticut, where students are effectively creating these big encampments, staging these pretty big protests, effectively asking their universities to divest from companies with ties to Israel. Protests have been, I would say, largely peaceful, though, of course, there's been a lot of focus on, you know, particular elements of these protests where there have been chants or even some borderline anti-Semitic slogans that have made Jewish students on these campuses feel very uncomfortable. I think it's safe to say, though, at least from what I've read, and I've tried to be following a lot of the student publications covering their campuses because I find they do it the best. A lot of these protest movements seem to be peaceful. A lot of them seem to include a lot of Jewish students as well. So basically what's happened is these demonstrations have happened and the response to them has basically been these universities asking police to come onto campus. And I think we've seen hundreds arrested and some students even suspended from their universities over involvement in these protests. That in turn has triggered even faculty at Columbia. We've seen scores of faculty members walk out in protest of the way the university has handled these demonstrations. So, I mean, the U.S. media has always had a fascination with kind of how big issues play out on university campuses. But what we're seeing now is it's actually kind of engulfed the nation. And you're seeing leaders call for the National Guard to be brought in.
Well, also, you know, does anyone remember Kent State in 1970? Like, it's really not good when you bring in the guys with guns to break up student protests.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's of course the concern about safety, and you know what is an appropriate crackdown and what is effectively kind of peaceful student protest. But equally, there's this question of freedom of speech and what responsibility universities have to their students to uphold it and to protect it.
Because, I mean, if you look at the history of political correctness in the late 80s and the early 90s, obsessed with anecdotes from campuses, the various books about wokeness, obsessed with anecdotes from college campuses, often misrepresented anecdotes. Why is the American media, I think more so than British media, so obsessed with what students are saying? You know, something very serious is happening in Gaza, and perhaps this should not be the headline story. Why? What is it? Is it that many American journalists have been to Columbia, Yale, Harvard, so on?
I think that's certainly part of it. I mean, these, you know, for a lot of the people covering, even my own university, my alma mater, the University of Southern California, was embroiled in a kind of Gaza-related scandal of its own making, where it basically decided to cancel the valedictorian speech, ostensibly for security reasons. But what critics see is, you know, them trying to stop her from potentially saying anything. Yeah, I think part of it is that connection. But I think also part of it comes down to the fact that, you know, I think universities in some ways are seen as like a bellwether for public opinion in the future. I mean, these are seen as the places where our future leaders, journalists, lawyers are you know, being molded. But equally, because I think certainly from the right, there's this idea of this sort of liberal campus, it being a focal point of like kind of what liberal America thinks. And so I feel like we have a propensity to navel gaze. And, you know, it's worth remembering that it's a lot easier for Americans, and particularly American journalists, to focus and hone in on what's happening on U.S. campuses than it is to focus on what's happening in Gaza, which continues to be cut off from international journalists.
I have to say, we had a lot of campus radicalism in the 60s. Obviously, we had a different kind of campus radicalism during that first political correctness era. And at no point does it seem to have produced a Congress rammed rammed with lefty radicals. So maybe the future leaders are not going to be the people in the encampment. Hello to the author of The Future of Trust and host of Jam Tomorrow, Roz Taylor. Hi, Roz.
Hello, Doreen.
Rishi Sunak has promised the UK's largest ever military support package to Ukraine, and Republican leaders in Congress have finally, after months of delay, approved $61 billion of aid. What is the cost of the delay for Ukraine?
It's pretty high. They've been forced to retreat in recent months on a number of different fronts. And it's unclear just how quickly they can get this new package of aid out to Ukraine. There's also an imminent risk in the form of what Russians celebrate as Victory Day on the 9th of May, which is when they celebrate victory over Nazi Germany. And there is speculation that Vladimir Putin might want to have a bit of a victory to celebrate that, and therefore might make a push forward. And it would be frankly difficult to get much out to Ukraine before then. Then there's been talk of a summer offensive and trying to push through a small town in Donetsk that would be a corridor to bigger places in Ukraine. So I wouldn't like to say whether it's too late or not.
I just find it remarkable that Mike Johnson, the House Speaker, basically said, oh, right, so I saw the security briefings and it turns out that this is like really bad and that we have to stop Putin taking Ukraine after 6 months of blocking it.
It's a long way away.
Is there like a secret room where even the dimmest Republican finally gets enough information where they go, oh, Putin bad? Anyway, Sunak wants the UK to boost defence spending to 2.5% of GDP by 2030. Well, I'm sure he will still be Prime Minister. The implication here is because Europe can no longer rely on the US, particularly if Trump returns, or indeed any Republican president in future, by the looks of it, unless they take them to the secret room. When budgets are tight, is this something you think Labour should commit to as well? I mean, I don't think they fully committed to it, but they've certainly been talking about it.
They have been talking about it. They are committed to 2.5% when resources allow, which is a nice elastic term.
When
Rachel says it's okay. So they have the aspiration to do that. But of course, this you know, puts the heat on them a bit more to commit, which is exactly what Sunak wanted. To be honest, we're moving in this direction anyway. If you listen to what think tanks and commentators in the defence space are saying, which I do as part of one of my roles, there is more and more talk about, right, Europeans need to realise that they might have to go to war. The soldiers have no experience of being on the battlefield, most of them. They've never, you know, assaulted a tank column or fought in a battlefield surrounded by swarming drones. There's all these warnings. And of course, part of this comes from a group of people who have been waiting for an opportunity to make the case for more defence spending. So to a certain extent, you have to be cynical about it. But at the same time, there is no doubt that Russia is a threat. And just so how much of a threat will depend on whether he's defeated in Ukraine, and if he's not defeated in Ukraine or part of Ukraine, what he chooses to do next. But of course, it's also worth pointing out 2.5% of GDP that Sunak promised is completely unaffordable.
Apparently, you just have to sack some civil servants and then shake the money tree.
That's what the Express was saying, but, you know, that's what the Express was saying.
Finally, it's Times radio host and Times columnist and general Times man about town, Hugo Rifkind. Hi, Hugo.
Hello.
Donald Trump's hush money trial is finally underway in New York. They managed to find a jury that was neither overtly anti-Trump nor too terrified to take part. Polls, we've seen some polls showing Biden creeping ahead nationally, or at least a bit of an uptick. Trump's legal problems let him play the martyr with his base. But, I mean, what do the normies make of all this?
Are there any normies? I mean, does America still have normies, people in the middle who are neither on one side or the other?
I think it's your classic sort of suburban women who kind of turned away from Trump in 2020.
I mean, so Trump is still ahead in floating states. It is quite hard to believe that anybody could look at him on trial for allegedly paying hush money to Stormy Daniels and have it change their view of Donald Trump. You know, it's not like any of this stuff has been in the dark. People know who he is. It's funny, I mean, you know, as you were talking about before, about the way the American media covers protests on campus, the way people drill down sort of so deep into it, really, really want to know what's going on. I feel after so many years, so long after Trump first sort of entered politics and was elected, you still don't see that kind of focus. And I mean, I'm not saying I could enlighten anyone. I don't know either. But it's sort of, from our sensibility, it's so much more baffling even than Brexit, where you could see at least what people thought they wanted and thought were getting. It's very hard to see that with Trump.
Before we start, some exciting news about Oh God, What Now? Live in Islington on Monday, May the 20th. Roz, Alex and I will be live on stage at the new King's Head Theatre in the very homeland of the Anti-Growth Coalition. We promised you a special guest, and we've got one. By popular demand, in the wake of her barnstorming performance on last week's show, Jan Ravens will be joining us to talk about the latest political nightmares and very possibly slip into character as Liz Truss to tell us how we've only got 10 years to save the West. There are very few tickets left, link in the show notes, but of course the best way to first dibs is to back us on Patreon. You'll get early bird notifications and a ticket discount. In the meantime, don't forget Monday 20th of May for Oh God, What Now? It's Grim Up North London with me, Roz, Alex and special guest Jan Ravens. We'll see you there. Let's begin. Rishi Sunak's Safety of Rwanda Asylum and Immigration Bill is ready to receive royal assent after a hectic night of parliamentary ping-pong between the Commons and the Lords on Monday. Sunak is promising that planes will be taking refugees there within 12 weeks. But will the plan actually work practically, morally or politically? Roz, can you explain the purpose of the Safety of Rwanda Bill? Does it make Rwanda safe?
Yeah, it does, in name. So the purpose of the bill is to enable government to deport to Rwanda asylum seekers who've arrived via illegal routes, which effectively means small boats almost always. Now, there are no legal routes. So if you are claiming asylum, you will default have arrived via an illegal route. And the way this is done is by declaring Rwanda a safe country. And saying that all courts must deny any appeals on the grounds that Rwanda is not a safe country, so that any asylum seeker who tries to appeal them will automatically fail. And they can be deported before their case is heard, because their case will apparently be heard in Rwanda, and Rwanda will be able to grant them asylum. We'll see how that goes. And there are about 52,000 people in this position.
That's a lot of planes.
Yes, it is. And, you know, even if the planes are full, it's going to take some years to move them all off. But we shall see, Doreen. We shall see.
I mean, it sounds like a brilliant plan. I don't think anything could go wrong. What did the Lords want to change? There was a lot of ping pong, which apparently is the technical term for this.
Physically.
And did any of those amendments succeed?
No. In a word, there were lots of amendments, but it came down in the end to key ones, which were that the UK could not declare Rwanda a safe country until the UK-Rwanda Treaty is implemented. Now, the UK-Rwanda Treaty basically is Rwanda promising to do all sorts of stuff to allegedly make it safe. And so the authors of the amendments also wanted a monitoring committee to decide that Rwanda has actually complied with all the requirements. Now, potentially, as you can imagine, that would take a long time. So that one was shot down. The second one that was shot down was an exemption for Afghans who worked for the British Armed Forces in sort of key roles that means that they're not safe in Afghanistan anymore, and that was also thrown aside.
Jesus. Hugo, Sunak seems very pleased with himself. He says, no ifs, no buts, these flights are going to Rwanda. Obviously, it's better for him to win a vote than to lose one. Is this really going to reap political dividends?
I mean, my hunch is no, but it's... Look, it might. You know, I'm getting a bit wary of saying none of this is going to work for them at all. There is enormous support for stopping the boats, as indeed there should be. You know, we saw 5 people die this week. I'm in favour of stopping the boats, for God's sake. Also, immigration is extremely high. A lot of people would like immigration to come down. Obviously, most immigration isn't coming in on illegal boats across the channel, but it is a totemic issue. The sort of the nub of this for Rishi Sunak, though, is whether people associate shipping people to Rwanda with A, stopping the boats, and B, lowering immigration, right? And logically, they shouldn't. Numerically, they shouldn't. But that being said, none of us quite know how these things sort of spread out in current rumour, convention among the illegal gang smuggling channel crossing community. It is possible, albeit unlikely, that this sort of this notion that, hey, if you go to Britain, they'll send you to Rwanda, does indeed spread and have something of an impact. But what this kind of sort of comes down to, though, is actually, although you think he's got through the difficult bit, this is the difficult bit. This is the really exposed bit. Mm. This is the bit where actually, if it turns out he is, even in the great dream, sending however many it was, 2,000 people a month to Rwanda, if he does all that and, you know, overall migration into the country is still pushing the million mark and the boats go up and up and up, then what the hell's it all been for? And that's what he's right on the verge, assuming it all goes ahead, of being exposed for, potentially.
Is there a gap in the polling between people who would like to stop the boats and may even support the Rwanda scheme in principle and people who think that will actually work?
That's not quite the polling I've seen, so I don't know. I know British Futures did a poll saying that basically most people believe, and I'll probably get this slightly wrong, but roughly this poll was, most people believe that sending people to Rwanda in itself is not enough to call this policy a success.
Right.
Okay. Right? Yeah, so, yeah. Which of course it isn't. You know, it turns out people aren't dumb.
Yes, I mean, as Hugo mentioned, the bill was being debated as 5 refugees died while trying to cross the channel in a small boat. I mean, these are desperate people. You do not make this choice if you think you've got a lot of options. Do you think that the threat of Rwanda, which, as we've been told, is very safe? In fact, Andrew Mitchell and Peter said safer than London. So, you know.
It's not safer than London.
Lovely. I think the bill says it is. do you think it really will act as a deterrent? Because I wonder whether if they're fleeing somewhere, they might well prefer Kigali to wherever they've come from.
Right, yeah. And I agree with Hugo a lot, actually, because I think, you know, the first point, of course, is it's really just hard to predict what the impact is going to be until the flights actually start setting off. But to your point, I don't think that if people are willing to risk their lives to get to the UK or to leave where they are, I think it, you know, where that final destination is, if indeed it's better than where they currently are, I imagine is immaterial. And I think, you know, if there are enough people who are still willing to take that risk, then I can't imagine the people who are responsible for smuggling people across the channel, I don't see them, you know, I could see them wanting to take people's money regardless of kind of what happens on the other side. For all those reasons, I'm a bit dubious as to whether the passage of this particular law is going to have an impact, much in the way that even just talk of Rwanda hasn't really seemed to have an impact, as we saw, even as Hugo mentioned, just this week, 5 people losing their lives, risking the journey across the channel. But the point also is that the status quo is untenable. And, you know, the government is rightly expected to do something about it. But this plan, which is not only expensive, I think it's going to cost about £500 million total in the end. But I mean, I don't know however much, you know, your average flight to Kigali times the thousands of people Roz mentioned. I mean, it's going to be very expensive.
If I may, it will cost more to send a person to Rwanda, we have discovered, than it would cost to send them to space. That was read out in Parliament.
It's one of those things where it's like, I think, you know, it's the sunk cost fallacy that we've been talking about this Rwanda scheme for years. But if nobody talked about it and someone just came up with it like now, and they said, this is what it's going to cost, this is how many people we can take, and this is the problem that it's designed to fix, I think anybody would just go, well, no, obviously not. But it's almost like once it was up and running and it became like a kind of an ego thing.
There's also a complete vacuum of ideas about what to do to stop the boats. I mean, the government has tried a few things and it's sort of tweaked around the edges and managed to get more Albanians sent back effectively and that kind of thing. But it hasn't. Nothing it's done has so far worked. It's a desperate move. It's last chance saloon. If this doesn't work, what the hell are we going to do? And that is the problem. And that is the problem facing Keir Starmer as well as Rishi Sunak.
I always just want to sort of insert a note of caution into sort of the I guess we're in a safe space, the liberal assumptions here, which are, look, if
that's
you
what I specialize
Rwanda is a stupid policy, as I think your sunk cost point is a brilliant point and very, very true. If you told me the Rwanda policy was going to work and do everything it said at any point in the near future, I would be like astonished. If you told me that 15 years from now Western European nations are routinely shipping unwanted migrants far afield to countries like Rwanda, I would not be surprised at all. So actually, I think in the long arc of history in a bad way. However absurd this looks, I think if we treat it only with disdain now, rather than what really, really could be a trend that is a major aspect of sort of foreign policy and migration over the course of the next generation, we run into danger of just of blinding ourselves really to what really could happen.
Ross, is there room for legal challenges now? I mean, if you're talking about, obviously the Afghan thing seems to be a moral disgrace considering what we owe a lot of these people. I mean, are there any exceptions or room for challenges if you're a victim of torture, slavery, children? Like, is there any sort of hope on that side, on the lefty lawyer side?
Well, your case won't be heard until you're in Rwanda, so you won't be able to argue that you're a victim of torture and slavery. You know, you are sent off to Rwanda to have your case heard. Now, in terms of children, if you're an unaccompanied child, they won't send you to Rwanda. The case will be heard in Britain.
Right.
But if you're part of a family, you will. How much room is there for legal challenges now? Quite a bit, despite all the government has tried to do. Migrants will try to appeal. They basically have about 12 days in which they have a window to appeal after they've been told, first of all, that they're likely to be on a flight and then that they'll definitely be on a flight. That gives them that window. That is way long enough for lawyers to move into action. There will be possibly a bit of a ding-dong with the Supreme Court, because you'll recall that the Supreme Court ruled that Rwanda was not a safe country. It didn't object to, on the principle of sending people abroad to other countries, which was interesting and speaks to what Hugo was saying just now. Mm. But it said Rwanda was not safe. And essentially, this law overrules the Supreme Court. So that creates a big tension between, you know, two big branches of government. It's basically undermining the judiciary. It's interfering with the judiciary, arguably, and there will probably be appeals on that basis. Then there's the option still, despite what Rishi Sunak would probably like, of going to the European Court of Human Rights. Now, the new law says that the government can ignore any ECHR ruling, but if they did, that would be awkward, to say the least. It would be a breach of international law that has all kinds of ramifications. Sometimes countries choose to ignore the ECHR. For example, France sent back a bloke to Uzbekistan, deported him not long ago. And basically the ECHR said, you have to have him back again. And so he was sent back off to France again. It's not a given, you know, you can't necessarily get rid of people permanently in this way. And there are other possible loopholes that mean that there's a clause in the treaty with Rwanda that means that these people can't be sent by Rwanda to any country except the UK. And that potentially opens up scope. If somebody commits a crime in Rwanda, they could, in theory, be deported back to the UK. So we'll see how it all goes.
Yes, I mean, the Tory right wants to withdraw from the ECHR and in some cases the United Nations Refugee Convention too. Yet, as Ross says, it was the UK Supreme Court that blocked the flights last November.
Mm.
I mean, is their real enemy not the so-called foreign interference, but human rights themselves, which they've managed to pin on foreigners temporarily?
To be honest, I think their enemy is whoever disagrees with them on this, whether it's the community of human rights or some other community. I think they would face their ire. I think what kind of baffles me, though, is that, and I think we've seen this in other examples, and Brexit perhaps being the kind of clearest case of just using one sort of issue as a panacea to solve all the others. But, you know, threatening to leave the ECHR would create more problems. I mean, quite aside from the poor optics, it's worth remembering that of all the other countries in the region outside the Council of Europe, there's Russia and Belarus. So that's not really the best company that the UK, I would imagine, would want to keep. But perhaps one of the biggest reasons not to leave the ECHR is the potential impact that it would have on Northern Ireland. The ECHR is a fundamental part of the Good Friday Agreement. I've been digging into more of this recently, but, you know, it kind of begs this question of if the UK were to leave the ECHR, whether that it would also potentially breach its commitments under the Good Friday Agreement. So I just feel like they're, you know, offering this one thing as a solution that's actually just going to create many more problems.
Yeah, it's like leavism. It's just like, exactly, things aren't working out for you. Just leave another thing.
It'll be fine.
Hugo, will Labour stand fast on this?
I can't see them maintaining this policy just because it costs so much. You know, just because when your next grubbing around for money in a budget and you're a Labour government and you've got this disastrous, expensive policy, you get rid of it. That is, again, I mean, as I went back to that, it's not to say that I can't see a future where a Labour government does want to handle migrants in such the same way. Because look, Keir Starmer's going to have a migrant crisis too. And I'm sure he will largely deal with it in a more sane way by focusing more on crossings themselves. That's not to say they won't sort of fall into the trap of, you know, mad blue sky thinking somewhere down the line as well.
Mm.
But I think they'll bin it, yeah.
It's a remarkable test for Starmer because it's fascinating. Well, I say fascinating. It is fascinating. The contrast between wanting to be tough on migration, which he will be, and he probably, frankly, has to be, and the rule of law, you know, and the way that he has always prioritised, because of his history and the kind of guy he is, the rule of law. So whatever solution he might have to this problem will not involve breaching international law. So it might be something, it might, goodness knows, I mean, you know, it's possible that the ECHR on refugee rights and asylum might change in the next few years. That is something that is entirely possible and we sort of don't really talk about much, but it's thinkable and it's being thought about.
Now let's have a question from one of our Patreon backers in But Your Emails. If you support us on Patreon, you too could submit a question to the panel. This week it's Jeff Stevenson who asks, what methods do you use to read books? Do you speed read? I mean, Dorian's book is bloody huge, but you all read it in about 5 minutes. Or do you buy the audiobooks and play them at warp 9? I do want to point out my book is not bloody huge. It's 400 pages, which is very reasonable. It's just got a lot of like source notes and index and all that. So it's not huge. It's a quick read. Fun. It's great. Everyone loves it. Anyway, moving on. Hugo.
Yes. You're going to say, did you read my book?
Did you like it?
I interviewed you about your book on Times Radio.
Yeah.
No, I think I'd have done a damn good job of doing that if I hadn't read your book.
You definitely read it.
That would have been impressive.
But I mean, you do have to read quite a lot of books to interview people on the radio.
Yep.
You have, I believe, judged a book prize or
yes,
two in
I
the
judged,
time.
I was a judge of the Wingate Prize, a Jewish book prize some 5 or 6 years ago. Hellish.
And
hellish.
There's just piles of the stuff.
Yeah.
So how do you get through them?
There are different rules that I have made up depending on what you're doing. If you're judging a book prize, you've got to read the books. Unless you very quickly decide the books are dreadful and then there's no way they're going to win the prize.
No better feeling.
No better feeling. You want to feel that as often as possible. If you are interviewing somebody for print about their book or you're reviewing a book, you've got to read the book and you've got to read all the book. Otherwise, you are lying and not doing your job.
Mm.
Broadcast interviews are a bit different, I find. Sometimes you do indeed want to read the book because it's just the nature of the book. The interview is not going to work if you don't. Or, you know, it's not impossible. You might want to read the book. That does happen. The amount of, I simply don't humanly have time to read all the books I interview people about on my show because that would involve reading 4 or 5 books a week. And I'm good, but I'm not that good. But also, and I'll say this carefully and certainly not about your book, Dorian, a lot of books are bullshit. Right? A lot of books, particularly the kind of books that make the media that become discussion points in the book, a lot of books are a column. And a lot more books are 3 columns. And at best, a lot of books are 5 columns.
They've got one point that they make a lot.
And so, yeah. So generally speaking, you can go a long way in understanding a book, certainly enough to talk about it with the person, certainly enough to find out more information from the person who's written it by reading the introduction. I mean, really, that is what an introduction is for. Also, final point, sorry if this is a bit too long, really you should have just read my introduction. actually, weirdly enough, if you're doing an audio interview with somebody, sometimes you almost don't want to have read the book, because if you have read the book in its entirety, you can end up having a conversation from which the listener is rather excluded, because the two of you know stuff that the listener doesn't. It's not like a print interview where it's your job as the person who's conducted the interview to present the reader, in that case, with all the information they might need. There's something a bit mad about doing an audio interview where you first announce everything that's in a book to the person who's written it and then ask them to say it again.
Like, what's your book about? It's not the worst opening
question. It's not the worst question, yeah.
Roz, you've obviously read a lot. You read a lot for Jam Tomorrow.
Judge
Book Prize,
yes,
Bunker, all of that.
Yeah.
Have you honed your reading skills?
Yeah, well, I've tried. I agree with Hugo. Most books are far too long. So reading the introduction, and often as well the conclusion, although sometimes the conclusion essentially repeats the introduction, which is also extremely annoying, but it can be useful to read both and get a sense of it. In terms of not reading all of them for audio interviews, I don't find that works for me because my sort of bunker interviews tend to be about half an hour, and I don't find I can sustain a full kind of half hour conversation about a single book without having read it. But yes. I think when it's shorter, that's fine. Also, if you are going to try and skim it, which I do quite a lot, you can often get a sense of whether an author is pursuing a rabbit hole. There's one I've just almost finished now, which you know, he's got a bee in his bonnet. I won't say about what, because I'll give it away. But he's got a bee in his bonnet, and he just carries on about it at length. And you can just, you know, you can take out those 50 pages quite easily. I'm sure that doesn't happen with you, Dorian, ever. My other advice would be to try and get hold of a hard copy, because although I quite often say, just send me the PDF, it is harder to speed read PDFs.
Oh, really? I find it hard copies because I hate it so much. So for me, what happened was, it was basically like a job. It was a job thing. It started when I started writing books, and you basically have to read a lot of books, and then obviously through research for Origin Story and stuff. And so you just have to become faster.
Mm. You can't speed read fiction, though.
No. Well, you can in certain circumstances, but I would say that I have two kinds of reading. I have normal person reading. You know, the sort of book where you're enjoying the prose and you're reading it a bit before bed and so on. And then there's like reading for work, where you're basically, you're looking for what you need. So I read Liz Truss's book, and it was like 90 minutes. I just sat down, it was 90 minutes, but I've read the whole thing. I was picking out lines, and I read it, but with a certain kind of sense of what I was looking for. So I don't know if it was skimming or just reading fast. And there were certain, like for the End of the World book, there were certain like Edwardian novels or whatever about the end of the world, which I was reading in an hour in the British Library, where you're at the desk, mm-hmm. and you're just tearing through it. And if somebody just went, oh, what was the relationship between Marjorie and Alice? I wouldn't be able to tell you, but I would be able to tell you they both died in a pandemic, you know? And so it's all about like, well, what are you reading for? Are you reading purely for pleasure? Are you reading in order to ask the author questions? Or just have a sense of what it is. As I got older, I've hated that thing where there are all these famous books that you haven't read. And I thought, well, I feel like I should at least read, you know, Ayn Rand or The Road to Serfdom or whatever, and at least have a sense of like what's going on, even if I'm moving fast. So it's like, I do think that there are these two kinds of reading, and I'm sure that if I ever did a book prize, it sounds awful.
You know,
again, it's another kind of reading again, because you're just going like, is this good, essentially, and then you're narrowing it down. What about you, Yasmin? You must have to do a lot of reading for research too.
Yeah. And I think for me, weirdly, the biggest challenge, I think I like adopt kind of a lot of the little tricks you all mentioned. And I find sometimes, as you were saying, Dorian, if I'm reading a book for like a specific interview or something, or I know what I want to ask about, I'll often, you know, you kind of catch yourself maybe sort of starting to fast forward a bit through bits where you feel like this is not what I need. Yeah. But I think the biggest challenge for me is actually carving out the time to do the reading. I find that most of my, especially for work, weirdly, I mean, I find that most of my day is spent like on calls or writing or reporting. And even like in preparation, like for an interview or something, if I have to read a book, I feel like I'm often doing it on my own time, which means that I need to carve out time that's kind of ideal for reading. And I think for me, like the biggest example of that is like if I'm commuting somewhere, and I have the time, yeah. and I leave on time, which is a big if, opting to take the bus or opting to take a journey where I know I'm going to be able to sit down and just carve out 20 minutes of just reading, like I'll do that. So yeah, I think it's, for me, the biggest thing is just carving out the time where you can kind of be alone, make a cup of tea, and just delve into it.
Because I found that when I kind of tweeted about how many books I'd read for research, and some people were a bit like, I can't read that many books. And you know, you do have to say, well, it is work. Mm-hmm.
I'm a TV critic, and it's fairly normal for me to watch 12 to 15 hours of TV a week. And a lot of people are like, oh my God, how can you watch 15 hours of TV a week? And it's like, well, it's literally my job. It's like, how do you do 15 hours of accountancy a week? You know, it's like...
Right, it's just like, you fit in a lot of dentistry in a week. I hardly have time for any dentistry. I'm normally too tired. Yeah. Next up, the local elections are just around the corner on the 2nd of May, circled on everybody's calendars. Voters will elect 10 metro mayors, 39 police and crime commissioners, 25 members of the London Assembly, and several thousand local councillors. Some Conservative councillors have admitted to feeling very restless and want to keep Sunak and Westminster at arm's length. Relatively popular regional mayors Andy Street and Ben Houchen are barely running as Tories at all. One senior Tory told The Guardian, MPs aren't on the battlefield this time. It's like the Somme without the generals. Those were the topical references, the Tory MPs. Everybody knows the results will be bad for the Tories, but how seriously should we take rumours of a leadership challenge if Sunak drags down Street and Houchen? Hugo, briefly, what is the doomsday scenario for Sunak and what would count as a good night for him?
Ben Houchen's actually a good one to look at. I think Andy Street is very possibly doomed, from an electoral perspective. Ben Houchen, who's not a very well-known man, he's the mayor of Tees Valley. His profile outside Tees Valley is not enormous. I expect we'll hear an awful lot about if he clings on. Suddenly he'll be this template Tory that they've apparently been going on about for years, a bit like, you know, the way sort of people claim to have always been into the Velvet Underground sort of thing. But look, I think the nightmare scenario for Rishi Sunak, it's almost like not quite so precise about these particular figures. The nightmare scenario for him is if he ends up with an awful lot of MPs who in their own constituencies have seen Tory councillors wiped out, because that reflects very directly on what's going to be happening for them in the election. So, I mean, I think the numbers they're talking about, I think there's an expectation that they could lose hundreds of councillors, 500 at least, I think, that they're talking about. But yeah, I mean, it'll be basically about how comfortable individual MPs right. feel afterwards.
Now, a leadership challenge would produce fourth Tory PM in a single parliament. And it's not good to have that many, I should point out. Is it really conceivable? It doesn't seem like it would project, you know, confidence and vigour on the part of the party.
Well, when things can't be worse, they can't be worse, right? And, genuinely, and it's sort of, so while it would be mad, objectively, it would be mad for them to replace the leader. Can you confidently say that the Conservatives wouldn't do better if Penny Mordaunt was leading them?
Things can only get better.
Well, things can only get better, quite. Like, I can't confidently say that. I think it's certainly very possible they'd do worse. But that's not actually a sort of a mad gamble to take if things are really, really, really that bad. That being said, I think they probably do go into the next election with Rishi Sunak. That would be my expectation.
Do you think the result, in one way or another, could affect the general election date?
If he does very well, relatively well, he's not going to do very well. If he does unexpectedly well, then I imagine he would try and do it soon. Although that, of course, itself could be... It was Theresa May, wasn't it, who did surprisingly well in local elections and immediately before she had a disastrous election.
Mm.
So, I mean, that the two don't necessarily relate in that way. But yes, that's the manner in which it relates. But the expectation is they will do badly and thus the election will be further away.
I don't know. I'm not sure about it. I agree with that. I think there's a strong possibility that they do really badly and he senses a leadership challenge might be imminent or it is imminent. Mm. He would just say, right, it's time to go to the country. We'll hold it in July.
Pull the trigger.
Yeah, exactly. Genuinely, he doesn't want to see that leadership contest happen. God knows how many of us want to see it happen. Jesus, just imagine. Anyway, but
bring trust back.
It's almost a more dignified way of going, isn't it? It's falling on your sword and it's taking everyone down with you, but it's falling on your sword.
Ros, the Tory mayor's campaign literature looks bizarre to me. Andy Streets is in green, insists that he's his own man, and essentially seems to be running like against the Tory party, or at least as if the Tory party doesn't exist.
Yeah, well, wouldn't you, Dorian?
No, I totally would.
But it's sort
of, I mean, I've got, as I said last week, he's one of the few Tories that I've got respect for, but perhaps because he's really trying not to be one. That's a bad sign. Even if say, Street and Houchen re-elected, but re-elected basically by going, it's nothing to do with me, mate. I'm just up here doing my thing. I've never met the man.
Yeah.
Like, that's a bad... I mean, they could celebrate. The Tories could celebrate, but it's not... It's a mixed victory.
He's not in a good place, Andy Street. I mean, he's always been semi-detached from the Conservative Party in a way that he wasn't a career politician before. You know, he came from John Lewis and that was his big thing. So... he's always been careful as well to distance himself from the Conservative Party when he needs to. And the obvious example of that was when the second part of HS2, when the Birmingham to Manchester link was cancelled. Mm. And he basically was very angry about that. Or he made it clear that he was very angry about that. He knows that Labour will probably win the next general election. So that means he won't benefit any longer from being a Tory, he's quite pleased with some of the ways in which he says he's been able to sort of shake up local funding, regional funding, so that regions don't have to beg for money on in kind of from little pots. And he's quite pleased about that. And he says that Birmingham has benefited from that. But at the same time, Birmingham is complex as well, because from the point of view of the local council, Birmingham is completely shot at the moment. It's in terrible financial difficulty. It's had to push through a massive, massive council tax increase and huge cuts to public services. Now, you logically shouldn't really associate Street with that, but some people may.
And reform is eating away at their support. If you look at the Birmingham race, Street would be doing a lot better if reform didn't exist. Do you think, could the results cause an even bigger panic than there already is about the reform threat? Would that almost sort of go, well, look, this has actually happened now?
Yeah. I mean, the reform threat is actually greater in the local elections, I think, than the general election, because the stakes are always lower as far as the electorate is concerned in local elections. And Labour hasn't yet generated much enthusiasm nationally, which, frankly, I would hope that it would do during a general election campaign, and people might, you know, feel energised, which clearly they're not at the moment, and they don't feel that Labour is an exciting and new option. The question I think voters might be asking themselves about reform is, when your council has very little money, as almost all councils do now, do you want reform councillors deciding where that money goes? Now, you may think that there's loads of woke spending to be cut, or you may think, I want grown-ups in charge when running a council is so difficult at the moment and all these really hard choices are having to be made. And as we've seen, reform candidates are sometimes not sophisticated thinkers.
It depends if you want a really, really big St George's Day parade.
Yeah.
I suppose.
Well, that. But yeah, so it'll be interesting, put it that way, to see how they do.
Yasmin, one MP asked a Dorset councillor how he could help, and was told, stay away. That's the best thing. You've got no added value, which is what everyone likes to hear. Now, in the US, obviously, local government is something very different, because they have a federal system. Mm. Are there similarly popular, perhaps sort of maverick local politicians who at the moment are trying not to attach themselves too closely to Trump or Biden, people who are sort of running on their own brand?
I think we've definitely seen it in the past, and I expect, especially as 2024 November, that is, creeps closer, that we'll see more of it. But yeah, particularly at the state level, I mean, I feel like we've seen governors and senators grapple with how to appeal to large swaths of voters while simultaneously keeping divisive figures like Trump at arm's length. I feel like one example, this is a couple of years old now, is Glenn Youngkin, who's the Republican governor for Virginia. He had to do this sort of like tricky balancing act when it came to not wanting to be too close to Trump, especially in the aftermath, I think, of January 6th. But I think from in particular this year, what I'm really keen to see is how particularly progressive Democrats handle the presidential contest. I mean, if you think of someone like Rashida Tlaib, for example, representing a constituency in Michigan, which of course there's going to be a lot of attention on, because that's one of the key swing states that Biden needs to win. And of course, that also happens to be where there's, you know, a lot of criticism against Biden for how he's handling the war in Gaza. So one can't really fathom any sort of Democrat saying anything that would, you know, be misconstrued as supporting Trump in any way. But at the same time, it may be really difficult for them to sort of toe the line of telling their voters to back Democrats while simultaneously distancing themselves from the policies that they really don't like.
I think it's just interesting that with the mayors, that you get people like Andy Street or even Andy Burnham. He's not trying to completely distance himself from Labour, but they're very, very proud of being independent. It's quite a new thing in British politics, whereas in American politics, because of the federal system, it's been like that for a long time. Hugo, let's talk about London. Listeners are always saying, why don't you talk more about London? So we're going to do that.
Well, it's sort of a blind spot for the media in London, isn't it?
Yeah. In the latest poll, Sadiq Khan is on 46% and Tory oddball Susan Hall is on 27%, a 19-point gap, but narrower than it used to be, especially in outer London. Khan's people are worried about changing the voting system to first past the post. Without second preference votes, it means that he could lose support to Zoe Garbutt, the Greens, or Lib Dem Rob Blackie. How surprised would you be if he lost?
Very surprised. People think Rwanda is the stupidest thing the Tories are doing at the moment. It's not. It's their mayoral candidate. It's remarkable the extent to which she has put people off. Sadiq Khan should be in trouble. You know, I like him. He's my kind of mayor. But, you know, London has a difficult reputation at the moment. There is a problem with knife crime. There is clearly a problem with policing. There are sort of huge cost of living problems. The city is, in a lot of respects, looks a lot like it's falling apart with potholes and everything. And while not all of that falls directly at the mayor's door, people think it does. So he ought to be in real trouble. The fact that the Tories have contrived to have a candidate who is even less attractive than a, what, 8-year now incumbent mayor, it's just pretty special.
Roz, let's look elsewhere to the northeast, where there is a new mayoralty. Jamie Driscoll is running as an independent after being left off the Labour shortlist, and he's become a hero on the anti-Starmer left because there was a real sense of injustice that he'd been blocked there. What are his chances of defeating Labour's Kim McGuinness? It's a sort of, obviously there is a big Labour wave coming, but there's also quite a lot of action on the left.
Yeah, I think his chances are pretty good. He'll appeal to voters who think that Labour isn't bold enough. There is a question about whether voters think if they got Labour mayor, their region will get more money. That depends on whether you think Labour's going to be rewarding regions who have a Labour mayor, or whether you think Labour's going to be morally upright and isn't going to do that kind of vaguely pork barrel politics. But I don't know if people are going to actually think in that degree of depth. His opponent, Kim McGuinness, the Labour candidate, is the Northumbrian Police and Crime Commissioner. So what he's trying to do is to exploit that by attacking her record on crime. And I wouldn't like to make any predictions about that race, but I think his chances are fairly good.
Because we've always got to be, there's certain people in the media who will be looking for the it's bad for Starmer story, and that's one of the possibilities.
Yes.
Well, Labour is also worried about new voter ID rules. You've argued that if people need ID to vote, then everybody should be issued some for free. The ID card was a controversial defeat for Tony Blair. Do you think that these rules justify it now, even if you're a little squiffy about it?
Yeah, I do, actually. I mean, it was actually pulled by the coalition government. Tony Blair's still really keen on it. He wrote a paper with William Hague recently.
But there was a lot of opposition, which is why he didn't deliver it.
Yeah, there was that. There was a lot of civil liberties opposition. I mean, I thought about this a lot for a Jam Tomorrow episode on ID cards we did. Bit of a plug there, sorry guys. But it was very interesting because we listened to people on both sides, and the civil liberties side and the pragmatic side, and Liam Byrne, who's a very big advocate for this kind of thing. And I ended up thinking that although we don't have an ID card, our details are held by the state at so many levels that we are effectively a kind of papers please society. It's just that it's not always papers that are being demanded. It's other forms of identity and passwords and all the rest of it. HMRC, the benefits system, the NHS. If you could actually bring those together in a logical way, it would save a great deal of hassle. And the question is whether doing that and bringing them together would be unacceptably authoritarian thing to do. Whether it would potentially give the government too much power to manipulate databases. Now, I tend to think the government already has that power if it wishes to use it. It's been incredibly stupid and messy, the requirement for voter ID, because if you don't have it, and quite a lot of people don't because they don't have a passport or driving license for whatever reason, why should they necessarily have to have either of those things? Councils have an obligation to issue ID to voters who don't have it, but that is a hassle. You have to produce multiple other forms of ID in order to obtain it. It's been really badly handled. It's democratically, I think, just unacceptable to say, right, if you want to vote, if you want to perform this basic democratic right, we're going to force you to obtain this document and this kind of document. That, to me, is just wrong.
Well, my life has become much easier when I learned to drive and got a driving license. And I was just like, this is really useful. It's a card with your photo and your address on it, which is accepted as ID everywhere. And you don't freak out about losing it the same way you do with
your
passport.
I don't have that. I have to take my passport everywhere, and increasingly so, and it's really annoying.
Yasmin, before we go, is there anything that you'd like to highlight for the local election night parties that would be sweeping the nation, like any particular parts of the country where you think, oh, this is going to tell us which way the wind is blowing?
Yeah, like the UK version of Iowa. Yes, I was actually trying to like figure out what the bellwethers were, and the local government information unit think tank actually had some really interesting stats on this, and they actually said that there are only 16 conservative controlled councils that are up for election this year. which I thought was really interesting, because mostly it seems that that probably means there won't, we may not see the headlines that we saw last year of of the Conservatives losing hundreds of positions, though I guess we'll see. But equally, I think because of that, because there's so few, I think a lot of attention will be paid to those. There are Conservative majorities in places like Gloucester and Dorset, which I think the Liberal Democrats are strong contenders. I think Hartlepool has been kind of seen as a bellwether a while now. Labour made some considerable gains last year. And I think apparently would only need two more seats to have full control of the council. So that'll be interesting to watch. Bolton is another one where I think no party has held a majority since 2019, but Labour are pretty close. Yeah. I mean, I will probably just be focusing on London because I'm an American who lives here. So I'll be keen to see what happens here. But yeah.
Listeners, send in the photos of your local election night parties, cakes, costume parties, however you celebrate. We've reached the end of the show, so what are the stories that have gone under the radar this week? Hugo.
Marshmallows. Marshmallows are not confectionery. Marshmallows are cooking ingredients. This was decided in court because the tax man...
The marshmallow man was on trial.
Yes, literally, big marshmallow.
Yeah.
Basically, the tax man wanted, I think, £500,000 from Big Marshmallow because there should have been VAT on marshmallows and some people weren't paying them. And Big Marshmallow won. And there's no VAT payable on marshmallows. This is, of course, reminiscent of the great Jaffa Cake debate.
Of course.
Which is in which Jaffa Cakes were deemed to be cakes. Although the big Jaffa Cake debate is the wrong Jaffa Cake debate, because the right Jaffa Cake debate is which end is the top of a Jaffa Cake. Because according to Jaffa Cakes, the chocolate is on the bottom.
What?
No, yeah, I disagree.
Fuck that, right?
I think that's wrong, yeah.
Nobody thinks that.
Well, Mr. Jaffa thinks that.
With all due respect to them, yeah, that's not true.
McVitie's weighed in a few years ago and responded to a tweet clarifying this once and for all, saying, our Jaffa cakes go through a reservoir of chocolate, so the chocolate is on the bottom. That's that.
The wrong people are in charge.
Yeah.
Roz.
I'm quite annoyed with Ofcom at the moment. They've ruled that Nigel Farage can carry on presenting GB News during the election period because he's not a serving politician. So unless he stands as a member of parliament, which he might still do, although probably unlikely because he can't be sure of winning any particular seat, he is free to carry on during this period presenting, albeit not actually reading the news, which is the distinction that's important.
And some might say that GB News is already a very, very, very right-wing channel.
Yeah, it is.
And so that it wouldn't really make much difference.
That's a pragmatic way of looking at
it. Are you worried about the principle?
Yes, I am. You know, it's a regulated channel. If you're going to have a regulated channel, then you have to follow the rules. And GB News has managed to basically get around them. And I think this is a bad thing. Basically, the Ofcom said, most people, we asked quite a lot of people, we asked focus groups, and they said they didn't really know how they felt about politicians presenting news channels. So we said, okay, then. Okay, but it's not your job to just listen to focus groups. Your job is to make a decision based on expertise and the law. Anyway.
Are the wrong people in charge? Part two.
I'm sorry. It's just elitist, isn't it? I'm going to shut up now.
You can't trust Ofcom. You can't trust McVitie's. Yasmin, what is your under the radar?
So I've been anticipating, as have many observers, the launch of civilian aid flotilla to Gaza from Istanbul. You all may recall that I think they've done many of these types of flotillas, which are really designed to sort of break the blockade of Gaza by Israel. The most prominent one was in 2010, which unfortunately ended up being quite a tragic incident where the Israeli Navy boarded these ships, and in one of them, 10 Turkish aid workers were killed. Well, 9 at the time. One was in a coma for many years and then died thereafter from his wounds. But there's a new flotilla that's going to attempt to break the blockade, bringing with them 5,000 tons of aid. In any event, I think that's something to watch. Obviously, after the World Central Kitchen incident, I think there's obviously going to be a lot of focus on yeah, sort of what the response is to this. But obviously, I think that the biggest issue is that this flotilla is saying that they won't allow Israeli authorities to check the goods that they're bringing. They're allowing port authorities from wherever they're leaving to. So yeah, that's one that I'll be watching that I expect we'll hopefully get an update in the coming days.
And that's the show. Thank you so much to Yasmin.
Thanks for having me.
Hugo.
Thank you.
And Roz.
Thank you.
Stick around for the extra bit after Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop, and a hearty salute to our generous supporters without whom we could not make these podcasts. And you can join them for as little as £3 a month. Get the podcast early without ads, plus lots more. Search Oh God What Now Patreon to find out how. We will see you next time.
Thank you so much to Roger Marshall, Joe White, Nick Devine, and G. Poole. We really appreciate it.
I would like to thank Bridget Ford, Mike, Adam Reddy, and Linda.
And many thanks from me to Gareth Brown, Joe Turner, Laura Labeds, and Jen Beaumont.
Thanks so much for your support to Jamie Randall, Susan, Kate Anathema, very punk name, and Andrew Henry. Oh God, What Now? Was written and presented by Dorian Linsky, with Yasmin Sahan, Hugo Rifkind, and Roz Taylor. The producer was Chris Jones, with audio production by Robin Lieber, video production by Kieran Leslie, and art by Jim Parrott. Managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, group editor Andrew Harrison, and Oh God, What Now? Is a Podmasters production. Hello, welcome to The Extra Bit, exclusive to Patreon backers. Tony Blair says that politics is lacking the vision thing and any positive idea of the future. Therefore, politics could become a branch of celebrity, so the people coming into politics are the weird and the wealthy. Certainly the current crop of MPs is not a golden generation. Scandals have been eating away at the Tory majority over the last few years. But is pessimism really the reason, as Tony says? Yasmin, we're going to have to start with the obvious example of a celebrity who is weird and wealthy, Donald J. Trump. But are there more like him? Is he the future of politics in that way, or sort of an anomaly? I was thinking it was J.D. Vance, semi-celebrity, like an author at least.
Yeah.
Semi-celebrity, if you read the New York Times op-ed pages, I guess. But, I mean, are there more people like Trump coming out of show business?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the most prominent examples from the like relatively normal to the extremely weird, I think of are like Arnold Schwarzenegger, my home state's former governor, and Donald Trump, of course. And you know, you have the likes of like even going back further, Ronald Reagan. I mean, it's certainly not a new point that Mr. Blair is making that you have like kind of celebrities and weird. I mean, you could also make the argument that weird people are more inclined to enter.
That was a teaser for the bonus bit of this week's podcast. If you'd like a little bit more Oh God, What Now every week without ads and a day early, then sign up to back us on Patreon for as little as £3. £3 a month. You'll also get access to exclusive monthly live minicast, Oh God, What Else, and a chance to get your hands on some of our merchandise and ticket offers. We're doing a lot of live shows this year. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.